Never thought I could, never thought I could. But when the lights are turning round, the wheels are rolling on the ground, the day I'll burn this whole place down, when the circus comes to town.
Okay, you're listening to WGXC Accra 90.7. This is Music for Open Ears at the Wave Farm. My name is Sal Cataldi. I am the host of a new show called Reading is Funkdimental. This is a book Actually, it's a radio show all about books about music. I'm a local musician. I also play in a band called Spaghetti Eastern Music, Space Heater, Guitars of Go-Go, Vapor Vespers. I'm also a writer. I write for the New York Times, Rolling Stone, Inside and Out, Upstate New York, and New York State Music, where I'm the book reviewer. So over the past 3 years, I've probably read about and reviewed about 50 or 60 books written about music, musicians, and today we're interviewing probably one of the finest rock writers there is, a guy named Joel Selvin. From 1972 to 2009, Joel was a very influential music columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, where it was all happening. He's the author of nearly two dozen of the best books on rock music and culture. His works have covered everybody from Sly Stone to the Grateful Dead, Ricky Nelson, Burt Burns, the Man of Rat. Wrote Twist and Shout, Sammy Hagar, and also events like the Summer of Love, the Birth of the Peppermint Twist, the LA music scene, and a book called Hollywood Eden, and the Rolling Stones' ill-fated concert at the Altamont, and also the whole everything that happened in Haight-Ashbury. We're going to interview today with Joel about his latest book. It's called Drums and Demons, The Tragic Journey of Jim Gordon. It's a biography of probably the most recorded and influential session drummer and drummer in rock history, who spent nearly three decades in jail for something we'll discuss a little bit later. As we all know, rock is no shortage of tragic stories. You know, there are the 27 Club overdoses of Jimmy, Janis, Kurt. Folks who met their end behind the wheel, like Duane Allman and Mark Bolan and Eddie Cochran. Folks who fell out of the sky, like Lynyrd Skynyrd and the like. But none is probably as horrifying, really, as Jim Gordon. Again, he was the most respected and recorded session drummer in the 60s on everything from tunes by the Carpenters to Glen Campbell. And he was also a member of bands like the Derek and the Dominoes, Traffic. He unfortunately, met a bad end and spent the last 30 or so years of his life in jail for something we'll discuss. So we're going to start and bring on Joel Selvin to discuss this fantastic book and maybe a little bit about many of his other great books. What I love about this book is that, you know, this is a guy who we really didn't say yet, but, you know, he murdered his mother, which is probably the most heinous of acts, but you actually really delve into the reasoning and a lot of empathy for schizophrenia, which is a horrible illness. It's probably the worst of the mental illnesses, and so you've kind of brought back at least an appreciation of his wonderful, wonderful, astounding work, which people should know about, and a bit about what drove him there. But first,
I hope to restore Jim's reputation, because it just disappeared. You know, that magazine Rolling Stone, for what it's worth, has a list out there of the greatest drummers.
Right.
And Jim's number 58. Number 57 is Sheila E.
Yeah.
Okay? So
that's really better than Meg White, I would say.
I wanted Jim to get his due. And right. What happened was that, as you say, Jim brutally and viciously killed his mother. And the world noticed that, but they didn't know anything that went up to it. It was right. Just the crime happened and everybody averted their eyes. None of Jim's friends or so-called friends supported him. Nobody came to visit him in jail. Nobody came to support him at his trial. They're just like, oh my God, he did what? And avert your eyes. Forget about him. And it was shocking. I mean, like you suggest, it's right. An incredibly horrible crime. But nobody was aware of the years and years and years that went before that.
Right.
That led up to that. The kind of torture that guy lived, the condition he was in, the premise of his illness. And that's also what I wanted to spell out. So the word you used was empathy. And yeah, Jim, in his lifetime, was never the beneficiary of very much compassion or understanding, and I wanted to bring that to the case.
Right. Well, the other thing that you did, which is astounding, as you do in everything you write, and I have to say, you are what do the kids call it? The GOAT, the greatest of all time, in my opinion, of a rock writer. Like I said, I did three of your books in the past couple of years alone, and I've read many more, but what you did is an incredible example of scholarship in a way. What you did to find out all the work, or you literally, if you could tell a little bit about what you did to research the many, many 3,000 plus sessions he played on.
Well, drummer Adam Minkoff, who plays with a wide variety of people around the East Coast, everybody Zappa. From Philip Glass to Larkin Poe, mm-hmm. Has a Jim Gordon discography on the web, which real early on in my research, I tumbled to and got in touch with Adam. Adam dug up about 1,000 union contracts, and the union contracts all show the session, who paid for the session, who produced the session, what songs were on the session, when and where the session was held, and everybody who played on it.
Right.
So it was like these things, and about 1,000 of them, I think, was probably somewhere around a third, maybe less, of Jim's union career. And that doesn't include all the non-union dates he did
right.
that were off the books. So, but nevertheless, this 1,000 pages was an incredible, rich kind of biography of Jim in document form.
Well,
there was also a bunch of research that was done by a couple of gals in 88 and 89 who had Jim's cooperation in writing a book, and they conducted a number of interviews with Jim in prison. And that time, I was able to acquire that research. So I had a stack of interviews with Jim. I had all these union contracts. And then, you know, I proceeded ahead with interviews. And I probably talked to 100, more than 100 people.
Right. Well, we're going to try to listen to one of his early works with the Beach Boys, which I believe he was playing orange juice bottles. He was a master of that, too. So let's see if we can get this. It's going here.
I came along when he broke your heart. That's when you needed someone to help forget about him. I gave you love with a brand new start. That's what you needed the most to set your broken heart free. I know you cried and you felt blue, but when I could, I gave strength to you. I'm waiting for the day when you can love again. I kissed your lips. Your face looked sad. It made me think about him and that you still love him.
That's some of Jim's work with the Beach Boys. If you... Oh, really? Oh, this is... Well, I okay.
It's true that, you know, he was just goofing around, and Brian Wilson saw it, and they took a razor blade to 4 orange juice bottles, those plastic things, and clock, 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 over
cool.
the drum track by Al Blaine, who's, you know, pretty much the usual session player on Beach Boys sessions. Jim was in there for extra percussion. And you'll never hear probably those
the same way again, because the orange juice bottles are very prominent in the mix. Clop, 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 clop.
Yeah, sorry about that. We missed some of that, but it is, yes, he does go ahead with the orange juice bottles there. He also did a lot of work he played on different drum. He is the beat on The Beat Goes On with Sonny and Cher. And if you could talk
isn't
a little
bit. Amazing. He played on different drum and The Beat Goes On.
There
isn't
you go.
Classic.
And many other works. And then how did he, so he kind of got into this because he sort of was covering the overage for Hal Blaine, because the Wrecking Crew is, if you can give people a little idea of who they were, they basically played on everything that came out of LA in the 60s and early 70s, and how he sort of got in with that group.
Well, Jim graduated from high school in 1963. And the next day, he went on the road as the drummer for the Everly Brothers. That fall, the Everly Brothers headlined a tour of England that Jim played on with Little Richard, Bo Diddley, and a group out of London that was making their first tour of the UK called the Rolling Stones.
Yes.
So by the time he came back to California and started playing on Everly Brothers sessions, it's getting to be 1964. We know Los Angeles was kind of a sleepy West Coast remote area, given the music business map at that point. Mm-hmm. But it was about to blow up, and Jim showed up on the scene just as Sonny and Cher, Beach Boys, Nancy Sinatra, Glenn Campbell, just exploded from out of Los Angeles. And within a couple of years, within a year and a half and even, Los Angeles had become this mecca, this recording center. And the session musicians that were working on those records were young guys. They weren't like
right.
The New York guys. They weren't like the Nashville guys. They were people who'd grown up listening to rock and roll. And so the records that were coming out of there were fresh and vital in a way that nobody'd heard.
Right.
The Jan and Dean records were monumental in terms of the kind of sound they had and the consistency of everything, and that group of musicians, you know, in historical ages would come to be called the Wrecking Crew.
Right.
At the time, it was just studio musicians, and they had no sense of themselves as a community. Even if the 20 or 30 guys ended up playing on a lot of sessions together.
Right.
And well, Jim had this supernatural talent. Everybody who heard Jim play for the first time, just, they couldn't believe what they heard, whether it was Hal Blaine or Earl Palmer or Jim Keltner. I mean, Jim Keltner has gone on to become like the greatest studio drummer of his time. But the first time he heard Jim Gordon play was at a session that Keltner thought he was going to be playing on. He belonged to a little folk rock group, and they were going to do a single. And he went to the studio and saw this silver blue Ludwig kit set up and realized that he wasn't playing. So he sat down on the floor next to the drum set, and his life changed right there.
Well,
Keltner had been a jazz drummer, and yeah, he'd gone to work with Gary Lewis and the Playboys because he could make more money than. When he heard Jim Gordon play on that session, well, the first thing he did was he went out the next day and bought a silver blue Ludwig kit.
Hmm.
But what Keltner told me, Sal, and this is why he's a brilliant guy, is he told me that I had to learn to play like Jim in order to not play like Jim.
Wow.
So yeah, that's the kind of impact that young Jim Gordon had on other drummers. And to this day, You talk to a drummer, and they're all aware,
yeah,
of Jim and his work, because it is so extrasensory, perceptional, that it stands out. You take a song like Layla. I mean, we all heard that, but the guitars are so dynamic and loud that it obscures a lot of what's going on
right
underneath in the rhythm track. Out there on the internet, there's a number of people who have posted the isolated drum track to Layla, mm-hmm, and you would be astonished to hear it. He's shifted the beat from the one and four. He's, I mean, it's just, it's genius drumming, and it seals the deal on Layla. If somebody had just sat underneath all those guitars, hitting the backbeat and keeping time, it wouldn't have been the same record.
Well, let's listen to one track that he did for actually one of his Wrecking Crew buddies who became a star, the original session guitarist, Glenn Campbell, who then went on to a lot of stardom on his own. And this is one where Jim really brings it home.
I am a lineman for the county, and I drive the main road, searching in the sun for another overload. I hear you singing in the wire, I can hear you through the whine, and the Wichita lineman.
Okay, that is Jim Gordon with Glenn Campbell. So tell us a little bit about their partnership together and the work he did.
I imagine that Glenn Campbell played about 100 sessions with Jim Gordon. I can't say for sure, but just, you know, all these union contract sheets, you see a lot of Jim Gordon and Glenn Campbell. I know they were on Everly Brothers records together. They're just wonderful. They played on tons of sessions, all the Beach Boys stuff and the Sonny and Cher. And the original Glenn Campbell hit, I mean, Campbell made records for years before he got on the charts, was Gentle on My Mind.
Mm-hmm.
And the version that we know of that record is actually intended to be a demo.
Wow.
But Jim's on that. It's a full-scale session musician crew. And they knocked out like 5 songs in that session just because they were demoing them. And the record company guy heard Gentle on My Mind and said, "No, this is fine."
Yeah.
It's Wichita Lineman where Jim really shines on Glenn Campbell records, because he's playing brushes all the way into the final chorus and makes a very stealthy switch to sticks and just drives the song home rather magnificently.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to another one that he actually helped make. This is, I wasn't aware of this actually, because I believe another drummer is on the back cover of this album, but he actually played with, on the first Crosby, Stills, and Nash album, a curiously mixed album if you're a drum fan. But let's listen to a little bit of what he did on Marrakesh Express.
Looking at the world through the sunset in your eyes, juggling the train through clear Moroccan skies. Ducks and pigs and chickens call, animal carpet wall to wall, American ladies 5 foot tall and blue. Sweeping cobwebs from the edges of my mind, to get away to see what we could find. Hope the days that lie ahead bring us back to where they've led. Listen up to what's been said to you.
Okay, that is Crosby, Stills, and Nash with Jim Gordon, Shuffling Away. There. Tell us a little bit about that one and how they got together.
Well, that was the first track that Crosby, Stills, and Nash recorded together. They went into the studio, you know, well, they needed a drummer. who else do you call? They eventually contacted Dallas Taylor, and he drummed on the rest of the album, but Marrakesh
right.
Express stayed with them, and Jim is on the track.
Great. So how and why did he make the change from, you know, this lucrative career in the studio where he was doing, what, 3 sessions a day, 6 days a week, making tons of money, and decided to throw that all away and get out on the road? How did that transpire?
Well, in 1969, the music world had changed rather substantially over the previous 3 years. And hit records were no longer the be-all and end-all of the music business. Now rock bands were performing live, and their concerts were rather remarkable. That fall, Led Zeppelin was out on this road. They're doing a 2.5-hour show with a half-hour drum solo. The Who was touring and playing Tommy. The Rolling Stones were going back on the road that fall. So the whole action of the scene was shifting, and Jim wanted into it. When he wangled his way into Delaney and Bonnie and Friends, he took over from Keltner just in time to do the U.S. tour as opening act for Blind Faith. Delaney and Bonnie and Friends were an incredible sort of white soul band, but they hadn't caught on with the public. But they were very, very popular with the record industry.
And with
everybody that was around Los Angeles had sat in with them and... Right. As they went on tour with Blind Faith, Eric Clapton became more and more interested in the band and started spending time with them after the concerts. And when the tour was over, Jim and the other members of the rhythm section went on a 2-month run with Joe Cocker, the Mad Dogs and Englishmen tour. When Jim got back from the Mad Dogs tour, about 4 or 5 days later, he went to London to put together a band with Clapton. Clapton had a concert, a charity concert,
right,
about 4 days later. So Jim and the other guys from Delaney and Bonnie, Bobby Whitlock and Carl Radel, hooked up and played the charity concert, which is where they picked up the name Derek and the Dominoes. And like 2 days later, that band went into the studio to help George Harrison work on his solo record. Now, George had always started the solo record with Ringo, but right, Ringo had had to leave town, and they came in, Derek and the Dominoes, to back George Harrison. Now, at this point, the Beatles solo album is the apex of the rock scene. This is the Olympian stature, and Jim, the first thing they cut in the studio with Harrison is "What Is Life," and you can feel the excitement, the command, confidence that Jim has just as he comes crashing in to Harrison's music, opening that song. And you know, they'd never heard anybody play drums like that in England. This was the highest level of studio drumming that there was. And you know, 2 weeks later, when Ringo came back and came to the sessions, they just handed him a tambourine.
Well, let's take a quick listen to some of that. This is George Harrison from the All Things Must Pass album, and it is What Is Life. We had to stick around for that playing on the chorus there. That's beautiful. So let's talk a little bit about where he went next. A lot of the problems sort of seem to begin with in the orbit of Clapton and Derek and the Dominoes, the recording of their album, and you mentioned here the Hotel Gift Shop in Miami that sold heroin.
Yeah, those guys got into a pile of drugs pretty fast. I gather that the first tour of England, where they played a bunch of small clubs and were relatively clean, was just riveting. But by the time they got down to Miami to record the album, everybody was deep into a bag of blow and heroin, and that began to create the sort of personal problems that would plague the band for the rest of its brief existence. And of course, the record company sort of screwed everything up. They had this brilliant album, but they put it out like months after the end of the U.S. tour. Hmm. So Derek and the Dominoes toured the United States without any records on the radio. Oh, or
I wasn't aware of that.
You know, there's no film footage of them. There's a brief 3-song appearance on the Johnny Cash TV show, but right. That's it for film footage of Derek and the Domino. Right. Broke up the next year trying to cut a second album. That was the end of it for Clapton. He went home and went into a heroin haze for 3 years.
Well, that Johnny Cash show, that's the one where Eric's playing with Carl Perkins. Yep. Who kind of takes him to
Matchbox.
The woodshed. He takes him to the woodshed on that one, boy. And I'm sure, you know, Clapton was gracious about it. But Carl Perkins was hunting for bear. He was like a real, I think, competitive sort of axe guy. But you also talk about, obviously, we should talk a little bit about the story of Layla and the coda and the controversy over the publishing.
They left Miami having recorded the album. Layla was just the guitars and it was 3.5 minutes long, and Clapton felt it needed something extra. So when they came back to Miami for the post-production, Clapton had remembered hearing Jim and his girlfriend Rita Coolidge play a piano piece in Olympic Studios in London. Rita and Jim had written this thing together, and Rita had written lyrics for it, and she gave Clapton a tape of it. But apparently it stuck in his head, and he asked Jim to drag it out. And Jim cut a piano part, and then they had Bobby Whitlock, the Derek and Domino's keyboard player, cut another version of it. And producer Tom Dowd made a composite of the two versions.
Right.
And just stuck it on the end. He called it the piano exit. And it turns a 3.5-minute song into a 7-minute song. But when the record company first put the single of Layla out, mm-hmm. they cut the piano solo off. And the record stalled halfway up the charts, and really, you know, nobody heard it. So for some reason, like a year and a half later, they put the single out again, only this time it's got the piano exit on it.
Right.
And this time it's a hit record.
Yeah.
So Rita Coolidge is entirely unaware that all this has happened. And she's doing a publicity shoot for an album that she has coming out. And they've got the radio on. And this familiar piece of music catches her attention. And she realizes, oh my God, that's the thing Jim and
wrote
I
that.
Did.
Yes.
Now, she calls up and tries to get people to pay her or put her name on the song, and they just laugh at her. But, I mean, that was sort of, you know, where it was at in 1969 in the record business. She and Bonnie Bramlett had written a song when they were touring with Delaney and Bonnie called Groupie Superstar. And Rita sang that song every night on the mm-hmm. Mad Dogs and Englishmen right. show. But when it was recorded, it was credited to Leon Russell and Delaney Bramlett. So she'd seen this before. And, you know, I have no doubt that Clapton was very well aware of where that piece of music came from. And I don't think he cared whether Rita's name was on it or not.
Well, let's just hear a little bit of it. The Birdie guitars played by Derek Dwayne. Derek and Dwayne, and here we go, just a little bit of Layla, the coda.
Thank you.
Okay, that is some Layla. From there, I guess we should talk about the Dominoes broke up during the making of the second album, and it had something to do with Jim's insane tuning of his drums and then him casting an insult at Clapton. If you could tell us a little bit about what happened there.
Well, that was just a flashpoint. Like I said, these guys had been so far down the road of drugs and alcohol that they had no personalities left to relate with each other.
Right.
And it had come to the point where they weren't going, there was no glue. There was a whole scene where Jim spent a couple of hours tuning a very large drum set and then got annoyed when Clapton started to tune, and Clapton got pissed off and walked out. And that was the end of Derek and the Dominoes.
Right. And you had mentioned, I think, in the book, which I did not know, that I guess Eric's preference was to have Jim Kelter in the band.
That was the original plan. I think Whitlock wanted to play with Keltner more than Gordon.
Kind of like Ginger and Jack. They know the devil, right?
Keltner is a really easygoing guy. He's
right.
A brilliant drummer. But he's not on Jim's level, and he'd be the first to tell you that. Nobody really is.
Right. Well, from there, how did he find his way into the band Traffic and to be featured on Low Spark of High Heel?
He'd been playing with Traffic before Derek and the Dominoes was
over.
He'd been playing on recording sessions. He'd been playing on recording sessions with other people. I mean, you know, Derek and the Dominoes was not a full-time job before it was over.
Oh, I wouldn't say.
It was over, Jim just started playing gigs with Traffic, and I think like within weeks after he was doing a UK tour. But he'd already been in the studio working on demos for the album that would become Low Spark of the High Heeled Boys.
Right.
He played on that entire album.
Right.
Did a UK tour, did a US tour, and then stayed in Los Angeles at the end of the tour and moved out of London.
Well,
went back to playing sessions.
So when did he do the... he obviously, we know he did a lot of work with George Harrison. He also is on powerful production, percussion on Power to the People by John Lennon. When did that happen?
Same time. You know, he was on that Lennon Christmas concert with that was so famous. He played on a couple of Lennon sessions out at Tittenhurst Park, Lennon's stately mansion in the country, he did a album with saxophonist Bobby Keys,
right? Great.
And the guitar players are George Harrison and Eric Clapton and Dave Mason. And Jim produced that album with Keys, as a matter of fact.
Right.
I played a lot of sessions while he was in London. Did an all-star BB King session. Did some. Harry Nilsson worked with producer Richard Perry. I mean, it was a very busy time. He was like the superstar drummer of London at that moment.
And then I guess while we're still on, while we were close to Layla and Rita Coolidge, let's just talk a little bit about what it seems his issues sort of started to pop up when he left his session work in the 60s and in his early 70s work with Delaney and Bonnie. So tell us about that incident with Rita.
Well, he clobbered Rita in the hallway of a hotel, and it came out of nowhere. They had been a couple. They were sitting in a hotel room with a bunch of friends just watching TV. He says, "Can we go out in the hallway? I want to talk to you." She thinks he's going to ask her to marry him. And he just clobbers her, knocks her unconscious, walks back into the room they were in, says, "Oh, I just hit Rita." And what that was a fissure.
Mm-hmm.
Because he had this internal turmoil building up in him, this turbulence that he was trying to mask with a complacent, calm, congenial facade. People always spoke of this easy smile that he went to, but Jim was sick, yeah. and he was dealing with internal forces that he didn't understand, and his only way of dealing with them was to keep them suppressed and then present some face to the world that the world could deal with.
Well, you talk about...
He got very skillful at that. But there were these fissures where things just erupted. And I assure you that they were as surprising to Jim as they were his victims. They weren't like using violence to control a female partner and it's like an Ike Turner way.
Right.
They were just these eruptions, and there were moments where he could no longer control all the turbulence that was inside him.
Well, he still...
He didn't know what was going on with himself.
Yeah. He still had his... He still was in top form in terms of his skills when he returned to session work in L.A. in, what, around 71, 72, was that, or...?
Might have been even more than top skilled. Might have been better than ever.
Right. Well, one of
the sessions that he was playing when he first came back were just phenomenal, and he was feeling incredibly powerful, creative urges. That's where he started working on the Rene Armand album, mm-hmm. and took over producing it and playing guitar and writing songs. And of course, he and Rene got married.
Well, let's talk about one of them, it was work with one of his favorite producers, a guy who for a while wouldn't go in the studio without him, Richard Perry, and the story of finally nailing the track for You're So Vain.
That's really Jim's masterpiece, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was in London with Frank Zappa doing a tour with this 22-piece orchestra, some of Zappa's most dense symphonic work. Is fantastic stuff. Had a night off, one night off, and he knew Perry was in town. He calls him up, and Richard says, get down here now. Unbeknownst to Jim, they've been trying to nail the drum part to this song, You're So Vain, all week. And they'd had first Carly Simon's drummer, Andy Newmark, and then they had a British session player come in, and they brought Richard in that night on first take. They knew they were going to have it. Richard Perry, of course, is this incredibly demanding and exacting producer.
Yeah.
He has microtonal sensitivities.
Yeah.
So Jim spent 5 hours doing maybe 60, 70 takes of this song before they were done with it. But it's Jim at his absolute most perfect. And what he does is nothing short of orchestrating the entire track from the drum stool.
Right. Well, let's listen to a little bit of that. This is Jim Gordon with Carly Simon. That is You're So Vain, Carly Simon, with Jim Gordon on the drums there. Let's move on to something that was a solo project of his, I gather, but it actually created one of the great breakbeats in rap, and that is the incredible Bongo Band and Apache. And actually, I heard their version of Inagata De Vita a couple of nights ago dropped in some television show. So somebody's making some cash off of that. But let's hear about the incredible Bongo Band and Apache in the beat.
This is another goofy story. It was anything but a Jim Gordon solo album. There is one of those. But it was some hustler in the movie business with a leg in the record business, and he needed a soundtrack for a B movie, maybe a C movie, and pulled together a bunch of drummers and made a drum record. But because this guy was a hustler, he put the insignia on the single that said it was made in Canada. It wasn't. But in Canada, they have laws that promote Canadian product.
Right.
And having that insignia on the single got him a lot of airplay up in Canada. None in the United States. Nobody even noticed the record. So he went up to Canada where former Los Angeles session musician Steve Douglas, the saxophonist who played on all the Beach Boys records and Phil Spector's records, he was living in Vancouver, and he pulled together a bunch of Los Angeles musicians to come up and play these sessions. And the guy's concept was the Incredible Bongo Band. So it was just like...
Were there any bongos on this?
simple little quartet and conga player by the name of King Erickson, who was just fresh out of a James Bond movie, a Bahamian guy, and Jim. And it's their record. They are the deal. But of course, I mean, the record came out and went nowhere. I mean, just nobody heard it. About 10 years later, a hip-hop disc jockey, one of the very first hip-hop disc jockeys, a guy named Cool, who called himself Cool Herc, found this record, and he took Jim's drum break and put it against Jim's drum break on another turntable, and he could keep dancers going forever by just going from drum break to drum break. Wow. So that's how it entered the hip-hop lexicon. It's been sampled, they think, more than 1,000 times.
Yeah.
It's just fundamental hip-hop sampling material, the Incredible Bongo Band. And of all things, there's a second album.
Wow. Well, let's just drop a little bit of that in. This is Jim with the Incredible Bongo Band, Apache. I don't know if we're going to come in on the break, but we'll come in on
the
something.
The pitch's pretty far in.
Yeah. All right, let's go far in here. Okay. Let's try it. Close enough. Well, that was a taste of it, so we'll leave it with that. But then he also was involved in one of the foundational disco beats, actually, with the Hughes Corporation. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Rock the Boat was the Hughes Corporation. They were produced by a guy named John Flores, who had used Jim on his very first session, which was Grazing in the Grass by the Friends of Distinction.
Yeah, another good one.
And after using Jim on that record, where he's just explosive, Flores favored him. I don't really know where they pulled that drum beat turnaround on the toms that became such cliche. Disco music existed at that point, but it was underground music, and it was almost exclusively in gay culture, Hispanic culture, and black culture. There was no white people playing disco music, and it wasn't on the radio. So Flores had to, this was an assignment. He referred to it as babysitting this group when I talked to him. He wanted them to cover an Alan Toussaint song called Freedom for the Stallion, and indeed they did. And that single really didn't do much. So the record company figured the album was over, but Rock the Boat had been picked up by disco DJs, and it was being played in clubs. And they put out a single of it for the clubs, and sold 50,000 records in New York before radio picked it up. Oh, what do you think we're going to do? They're going to, you know. Anyway, that was the first disco record on radio. It was a number one hit. And, yeah, that's Jim on drums. It's amazing that he would be sitting there. But That's the guy.
Well, through that era, like his second, let's call it his second chapter in session work, he was on things like Helen Reddy's I Am Woman, Seals and Croft, Summer Breeze, Tom Waits, Looking for the Heart of a Saturday Night, Little Hall and Oates work, Ricky Don't Lose That Number by Steely Dan. Let's take a detour into Zappa. Zappa is, when it comes to musicians, you know, Frank was the guy who could find the greatest. And he's on record in some places saying that Jim might have been the best that he played with, or certainly one of the best. Tell us a little bit about the work they did together.
Jim cooled the audition. He walked in and did a cold reading on the charts. And I don't know if I can say this on radio, but the Zappa charts are what musicians call fly dung.
Right. Yes.
Sprayed with little notes, and Jim just sat down and played and read. And right. Zappa was blown away. He had that skill. I mean, he could read. He was trained. He knew every nuance of the world of percussion. And he loved Zappa's work because it had this incredibly disciplined, incredibly proscribed portion, and then it had a lot of improvisational portions.
Right.
So you could move from this absolutely composed part to the part where you, and that's where Apostrophe comes from. Apostrophe, yeah, is the title track of Zappa's best-selling album. It comes from an 8-hour jam session,
wow,
featuring Zappa on guitar, the other guitar player
Tony
from his
Duran,
band,
yeah,
Jack Bruce from Cream on bass, and Jim on drum.
Well, let's,
and they're just 8 hours in a New York studio, and sometime later, Zappa took a razor blade to that and came up with that 4.5-minute track of Apostrophe.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of that 4.5-minute track. It's amazing, so here we go.
It is.
Jack Bruce, fuzzing away. There we go. A little bit of Apostrophe. We're kind of running to the end here. So I do want to talk about, you know, how well you handled. Let's talk a little bit about his illness, the horrible thing that transpired. And he just recently passed away a couple of years ago, I guess. So let's just talk about the final chapter of his life there.
Well, you have to understand that Jim started seeing psychiatrists in 1975. He really wasn't forthcoming or honest with them about what was going on. His performing career comes to a kind of sudden end in 1978. And that's about the point where he starts entering mental hospitals. And in the next 5 years, he would check in to mental hospitals 15 times.
Right.
He was the subject of kind of brutal early psychiatric medicine, massive anti-psychotic drugs, massive tranquilizers, to which Jim himself added enormous amounts of alcohol and illegal drugs. Alcohol may have been his best coping tool. In fact, it quieted the voices down in his head.
Well, he was misdiagnosed for a long time. His mother, who we know, you know, met her and via her son, was a nurse, and his father had been an alcoholic. So she kind of thought his problems were mainly due to drugs and alcohol, when they were actually due to the schizophrenia.
That's right. She would take him to AA meetings she was a labor nurse, but you'd think, you know, medical professional would have some insight into this, but she never did. Jim's head was crowded with voices commanding him to do things. If he did not do what the voices told him, they would give him a severe headache. The psychiatrists know this as the electric hat band. Right. Jim called it white hot cruelty pain.
Terrible.
And all this panoply of voices, the lead voice was his mother. Yeah. And it was a real strange sort of thing because he would be like having dinner at his mother's house and she'd be fussing over him, wondering why he wasn't eating his dinner. But in his head, she'd be yelling at him, telling him, if you take one more bite, you'll die. Right. So he was caught in a reality that you and I can't understand.
And then
he was out of step with what we think of as the real world.
So
and the world Jim lived in was a terrifying hellscape where he was subject to treacherous and severe punishment and had to carefully work through life. Psychiatrists had a hard time diagnosing him because he was so high-functioning, and he had this incredible career going on. Hell, he was making more money than all the doctors were. But so they thought he might be depressive or have a mood disorder. He was not diagnosed as schizophrenic until after the crime.
Yeah, so we have about a minute and a half here. So tell us, you know, what transpired and, you know, how he actually refused parole, I believe. So tell us a little bit about
it. I think Jim was kind of comfortable in prison. Going to prison is not a cure. So he still heard voices and was schizophrenic and had to suffer that. Of course, in order to keep in the hospital wing of the California Penal Authority, he had to agree to take meds. So he was being medicated out of his brain. And he got a lot of royalties from Layla, so he didn't have to take a job in, like, the prison laundry. He had all the commissary money he wanted. Other people who were inside with him described kind of remote figure. He didn't hang out on the yard a lot. He wasn't in bands with everybody. He just was sort of quiet and kept to himself. And he routinely did not show up for his parole hearing.
Well,
you got to figure, you know, he knew what was what and figured that was the place where he was safest and best and stayed there. He died last March. He was 78 years old. He had spent 39 years in prison, and he was 38 when he went in. So he spent half his life in prison.
Well, sorry, we have to wrap this up. We could have gone longer. Joel, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. I love talking about Jim.
We're going to go out on one of Jim's final pieces. He was the Muffets drummer. And here we go. This is, we played on this, Rainbow Connection. Thanks a lot for listening, folks, and we'll see you next time.
Why are there so many songs about rainbows? And what's on these?